Okay, well, welcome everybody. First we're going to have...
What? It's going to bother you. Okay.
No,
All right, if you're talking in the background, please mute your phones. I think it's *6 to do that. So welcome to the Climate Literacy Network call. First, I'm going to ask for any announcements of any kind. Scott, I know that you had one that you might like to mention.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out to folks, Scott Mandy has sent down a link this morning and to the Tony Leesowitz report. They did a survey about the electorate and their attitudes towards climate change. And I thought it was quite interesting. I just looked at it myself, so I just want to point that out to folks. Let me see if I got the time for when Scott sent it. It was came to me today at 7:54 Pacific time, so around 8 o'clock or 11 o'clock.
7:54 Pacific time, okay.
Yeah, and it's just at the environment.yale.edu website, you know, with climate and part of the group that he runs there. So. I thought it would be quite interesting for folks to look at what the electorate is thinking around climate change. It's actually kind of encouraging. There's certainly some opportunity there for some discussion around climate change. So, just point that out.
Did you send that link out? I don't remember seeing it.
Yeah, it just came from Scott Mandia on our listserv. And if you want, I can give you the whole link. It's environment.yale.edu/climate/publications/global-warming-2012-election.
Okay, hopefully I can. Okay, it's the Yale project. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. But it's new stuff, and I think it's kind of interesting to look at those results.
Cool, thank you.
Yeah. And again, thanks to Scott for sending that around.
Well, could you send that link to everybody, too? I didn't quite get it. Eventually.
It should be. It actually should come up in your in the listserv.
I didn't get it this morning for some reason.
Okay.
Scott, what was the subject line?
It was CLN members, and then in square brackets, new post, it's time to explain America's climate options.
Did not get it.
Yeah, that was it.
Oh, I got that.
So I've got it. All right, I'm going to send it now back to the Climate Literacy Network.
Yeah, very good.
All right, I just sent it again. Okay, I have a couple announcements. One is that the Clean Pathway Project did get a supplement that the funds ultimately came from the Department of Energy, and we are going to be using the Climate Literacy Network venue to involve curriculum developers around energy resources, very appropriate for this presentation today, share on the Climate Literacy Network telecons and to have some of their resources go through the clean review process. So we'll be getting more energy resources in the collection, and we'll be facilitating that community of energy curriculum developers over the next year or so, and we'll be leveraging the Climate Literacy Network quite a bit for that. So you'll be hearing about all of those and be able to provide input to those efforts. The other good thing here is that we'll also, we have found funds to develop out the energy literacy pages. For those that are not familiar with the the Clean Pathway Portal, in addition to the reviewed collection of resources, we also have pages that provide some information for teachers on how to teach and the challenges of teaching the various climate literacy essential principles. And when those pages were initially developed, there were no energy literacy principles. So we developed the tentative set for the project itself and have one page, but now that there are an established set of energy literacy principles, we will be going in and developing full pages for each of those essential principles. So those are new things on the horizon with respect to clean, and I am also in the process of writing a DRK-12 proposal that will leverage clean in addressing the next generation science standards. So that's another expansion of our efforts. I just wanted people to be aware of.
And relatedly, I'll note that those of you who are familiar with the rainbow chart of big ideas, I have extended that to include the energy literacy principles, and I'll have copies of that at NAAAE and can send folks the link for that too if they're interested.
Oh, good.
That's great.
Are there any other announcements? Okay, well, if not, then we'll move on to our presentation for today. So we have Don Dugenhaus is going to be presenting. He's a senior education research associate at the Museum of the Earth at the Paleontological Institute Research Institution in Ithaca, New York. And he's been very involved in the development of the next generation science standards. And as everybody who's on this call often knows, Don has also been very instrumental in moving the Climate Literacy Network forward. So we thank him for that. And he's going to talk to us today with a talk entitled, There's No Such Thing as a Free Megawatt, the Marcellus Shale as a Gateway Drug to Energy Literacy. So, Don, I will turn it over to you.
All righty. Thank you. So hopefully everybody's on the presentation, which is a Prezi, and I'll say a word or two about that because it's unfamiliar to a lot of folks. It's a presentation tool that is kind of a, I would say, maybe a distant cousin of PowerPoint. It allows you to do a lot of things that PowerPoint can't do and can't do certain things that PowerPoint can. But it's the entire presentation is on a what they call a canvas, a big canvas. So you can zoom in and zoom out. And one of the things that I really like about it is that we've all been in those presentations or classes or whatever where the presenter says, here's a diagram that I know you can't read, but I'm showing it to spite you anyway, which in reality there are good reasons for showing complex diagrams that you can't read all of to get big picture stuff. But with this, you can zoom in and zoom out. I will let you know when I'm clicking forward, and hopefully folks will keep pace. I see there's only one person following the presentation link, so there are room for more if you want to come in that way. If you do zoom out and get kind of lost, let me know and I'll point you to a landmark to get you back on the path. But if you just click your forward and reverse arrows and go along with me, I think you'll be okay. It's the presentation is one that I've done in person before. I've never done it online, so we'll see how this works. And I start off typically, and I've done this only in New York State so far, so I generally ask this first question about New York State, and there's a simple little one question poll that you can take, and I can see your answers come in, and I see 10 people have, or 9 people have answered so far. And I do that with New York State for reasons that I'll come back to in a few minutes. I'll say take a moment and click on that link. If you're in full screen mode on the Prezi, you need to escape from full screen mode to see the link for the poll. So you can click on that while I move ahead. So I clicked once to my title slide and a second time to expand out on that, and then to the next, which is a second possible title is Complexifying the Seemingly Simple. The issue that we're talking about is a very controversial one in New York State and other places too, where, as with many controversial issues, a lot of people make up their minds very quickly on a gut response, and the issue is really quite complex. And so I'm going to click on to the next string of things, which has, first off, what to expect, a bulleted list here, which if, as you click through, those bullets will pop up. So what I'm going to do very quickly is a whirlwind overview of the science related to hydraulic fracturing in the Marcellus Shale, place it in the context of the larger energy system, have some discussion about the educational challenges of the work, and point to a bottom line that is simple, going back from that complexity to a simple message that this points to, that we need to use a whole lot less energy. And there are spots in there where there is more information if you click on an icon, but I'm guessing we won't have time to click on any of those. So next on to a question of, is slick water high volume horizontal hydraulic fracturing bad for the environment? And you know, the bottom line simple answer is yes, it is. But, and I'm clicking through here, I want to get us to asking richer questions. And a richer question is something like, is hydraulic fracturing better or worse for the environment than what we're doing now or might reasonably do in the near future? And that's a much more complex and I think more important question, because it is bad for the environment, but so is everything else. So two important questions that are really the theme of this whole thing is, should we use this kind of energy and should we use this much energy? So trying to bring people to deeper questions. And some thanks to my colleagues. Link for the presentation. There is also a Google Earth file with some more stuff in it that when I do the presentation live, I pull that up for doing this online. I've plugged some screen grabs from the Google Earth file into the Prezi. So the first one of those is looking at New York State with the Marcellus Shale exposure highlighted from a USGS geologic map. And you can see a little bit of the Utica Shale, which I've turned on as well, with a layer in the USGS map that is available for looking at that. And looking at that shows you the line of exposure where there's actually an exposure about 10 miles from where I'm sitting in a park in Lancaster, New York, and that runs roughly parallel to the New York State Thruway. And everywhere south of that line in New York State has Marcellus Shale underneath it. Everywhere north of that line, it's eroded away. So that gives you a little bit of an idea about where the stuff is. And let me pause and ask if folks are keeping up okay on my clicking.
I'm doing fine clicking through, Dawn.
What'd you say?
It's going fine clicking through on my own.
Okay, good, good.
And I'm watching from your direct, you're clicking through, and that's working fine, too.
Good, good. Yeah, and there's only three folks in the online presentation, so if others want to follow that link, there's still room for seven more. There's a little bit of imagery in this presentation from PowerPoint by John Williams from the USGS, and I appreciate that. We have
John, can you tell us what page we're on?
We are right now at Marcellus Shale. An image that just says the Marcellus Shale, the science beneath the surface. URL for our Marcellus Shale resources. So it's 15 clicks in or something like that. You click through pretty quick on some of this. And this is done with support from two NSF grants and so that I draw the phone.
Are people able to hear Don? I'm losing half of his words.
I'm losing half of the audio also.
Yeah.
Don, can you hear us?
Fine. Let me dial.
We're having trouble hearing you. Your words are getting cut off.
And I will be able to reconnect with you here.
I had a little bit of trouble with audio issues. My ways of calling this here, and hopefully that'll fix it up.
John, are you there?
Again, in a different way.
All right, I'm still not getting all of your words, but I'm not sure you're talking either.
Hi, I'm back in a different way, so hopefully this audio will work. Apologies.
Okay. That's a lot better.
Hey.
Okay. Sorry. So we have a couple of NSF grants and a third grant from a foundation funder that I'm drawing a blank on the name of. And the NSF grants, one is to produce materials without really educational support, and the second, which is the one that I'll be talking mostly about today, is working with cohorts of educators within communities and a range of types of educators, So targeting specific communities. Specifically, those communities are Elmira and Binghamton, where in each community we've got classroom teachers, museum professionals, college and university folks, including community college folks, and a Nature Center director in the Elmira cohort as well. And we're also connected with the Cornell Cooperative Extension in much of our work, as well as being part of Cornell University's Marcellus Shale team, which is brings people from around campus together to study the Marcellus Shale. So we're involved in all of those things, and in all of that work, very importantly, we do not take a position. I clicked now to the slide with the red header. We don't take an advocacy position for or against drilling in the Marcellus Shale, but are doing our level best to provide as close as we can come to the unbiased science of the shale. And we recognize that it's impossible to be unbiased, but we're doing our best. And evidence-based information about the shale. And as I said with the little poll at the beginning, I generally ask that of New York State audiences, and a little bit more info on that is that in many of the last several years, the top two sources of electricity for New York State have been roughly tied. In 2008, each produced about 31% of the state's electricity. And I'll cut to the chase for New York. That's the two biggest sources are natural gas and nuclear. And almost everyone that I ask that question of gets it wrong. And that I'll come back to in just a moment, but if you click to the map of the U.S., it's got the electricity generated in each state in pie graphs, and you can zoom in and see how you did. And I looked at this in the earlier responses to this question and saw that you folks do better than the average New York State audience, where maybe it's a little bit easier, but still many of you are missing one or two of those top two sources for your state. So you can take a look and see how you did there. There are a couple of reasons that I ask that question. If you click once, you zoom in on New York State, and if you click a second time, then you go to why I included the poll, and as you click through that, those will pop up. The first reason that I include the poll is that we know from studying how people learn that engaging relevant conceptions to whatever you're trying to help people understand really matters, and getting them to think about what they already know or think they know in relation to what you're trying to
help people understand. And the second point is that I know that most people get the question wrong, and it's kind of fun to ask questions that people get wrong. But really, the third bullet there is the key idea of raising the question of, can we make informed decisions about changes to the energy system if we don't know where we currently get our energy? And like I said, the overwhelming majority of people don't know where their electricity comes from. In 2010, New York State got 36% of its electricity from natural gas, most of which comes from neighboring states in Canada, although we do, as we'll see in a little bit, have some natural gas in New York State, and in fact, the first commercial gas well in the U.S. was drilled in 1825 in Fredonia, New York, just a 40-minute drive from where I'm sitting outside of Buffalo right now. So that that question is part of a larger strategy of trying to get people to switch mental gears from an instant response to more analytical approaches, and citing Dan Kahneman there to help people switch gears from system one to system two. And I found that book very helpful, and if you've not looked at it, I recommend it highly. And I need to pick up my pace. So I might skip some stuff here a little bit. So some key ideas and a key question. We think that the Marcellus Shale and the natural gas within it can't be meaningfully understood without understanding the larger energy system. Our energy system is changing fairly rapidly in a lot of ways, and staying the same in a lot of ways as well. All large-scale energy production has negative environmental impacts. We want folks to think about what's more important, where their energy comes from, or how much we use. I think to make sure that I've got time, let me ask a question or two. I've got just a little bit on this related science of hydraulic fracturing and some numbers there, and I am taking more time than I sometimes do. So I'm wondering, should I spend a couple of minutes on this or just skip past it?
Well, what will we be skipping past too?
Well, we'll be skipping past to larger things related to the larger energy system and how that's changing. And then in educational questions and real discussion that I want to make sure I have some time for.
All right. Well, why don't you go ahead and skip to it, and if people have questions, maybe you could come back to it.
Okay. So I'm just going to click a bunch of times. Pardon me?
Good idea.
Okay. So I'm just going to click a bunch of times to fly through this brief overview of fracking and fracking fluids and the technology, pointing out that we do have a long history of natural gas development in New York State, and there's a very quick flyby of Chautauqua County, which actually has 5,000 gas wells within it. And now I'm going to the point where it says parts of the energy system are changing rapidly, and going to that lovely colored graph from the EIA, the Energy Information Administration, that shows the title of the graph is current 2010 capacity by initial year operation and fuel type. And I think this is a fascinating graph that you could spend a lot of time on. It shows all of the power plants in the U.S. and the year that are currently operating and the year that they came online and what their fuel type is. So it shows, click on and zoom in, that almost all the really old plants that are still online are hydro. That doesn't mean that every power plant built in 1940, in the 1940s or the early 1940s were hydro plants. It means that the power plants that were built in the 1940s that are still online are almost all hydro plants. so
that shows some a variety of things about our electric system. And I spend time mostly on electric for a couple of reasons. For one thing, in the time frame, you can't address all aspects of the energy system, and the electric is the most is the largest piece of our energy pie. So, looking at this graph, there are a number of things that I think are fairly interesting, and I'll maybe ask you for a minute. You know, what leaps out at you as you look at this graph?
Since 2000, that's what jumps out at me.
Yeah.
So this is just showing you when plants start, went into operation. Is that what this is saying?
Yeah, it's showing you how much capacity in terms of the gigawatts produced and when it came online and what type it was. So it shows that there was a whole lot of natural gas capacity, electric generation from natural gas that came online in the U.S. about 10 years ago, a tremendous amount of natural gas development. So that's one thing that really leaps out at me. It was the first thing that's caught my eye when I opened it up. Another thing, and I can actually click through some of this, you can actually see big power plants make bumps on the graph. So the Robert Moses Power Plant at Niagara Falls makes a little bump there, and that's the biggest hydro plant east of the Mississippi. You can also see that there isn't much in the way of new hydro, and my guess is that a lot of people on the call know why that is, but I'll ask you anyway, and you can tell instead of me telling, why isn't there much new hydro?
Are they silting up behind the dams now?
Well, they're silting up behind the dams, but that reduces capacity some, but it doesn't really explain why they're not building new stuff. So this is, you know, this is again showing how old the power plants are. And it
did they build all the capacity out for all the existing rivers that can be used for it?
Yeah, that's
you're going to flood a bunch of people now. People aren't going to stand for that now.
That's right. Hydro has pretty substantial environmental impacts if you flood a valley or a gorge. People tend not to like that, and years ago, that was okay in the view of many folks, but now hydro plants are actually being taken offline to restore habitat, and the most obvious places are already occupied, like Niagara Falls, for example, which has a 2.4 gigahertz Robert Moses plant on this side and the Sir Adam Beck power plant about the same size on the Ontario side of the river. There aren't any other Niagara Falls around that don't already have hydro plants on them in the U.S. Other points of interest is that you see the nuclear plants coming online for a period of 20-some years between the 60s and the 90s, nothing since 1994. You see that great big spike of natural gas 10 years ago or so. And why is that? Why 10 years ago was there this boom in building natural gas plants?
It's got to have something to do with air emissions and maybe acid rain or things like that,
yeah.
Coal.
That's exactly right. Many northeastern states sued midwestern states over acid rain from coal. And part of the settlement of that suit was converting coal-fired power plants to natural gas or taking coal-fired power plants offline and replacing them with natural gas. Enron has something to do with it, too. I don't know the details well enough to say much about that. And another really striking thing from this graph is that more power came online in 2008 and 2009 from wind than from any other source. But coal was still in the picture, and in 2010, there was either one or two really big power plants that made it so that coal was the biggest source of new capacity in the U.S. in 2010. I believe in 2011 it was wind again. That
gives you a sense of there is real change taking place in the energy system, and that's a bit of a snapshot of it. When, and I sort of blew by the science of the shale, but and this came from an earlier CLN presentation back in March by Allie, and I really like this, and it plays into the history of fuel or highlights aspects of the history of fuel that I think are really important to understand, that we have throughout human history found sources of fuel that were pretty easy to get, figured out how to use them, until we used so much of them that they became harder to get and more expensive to get and more environmentally damaging to get. And while the pursuit of that more difficult to access resource was going on, someone was developing a different energy source that ceased one form of environmental damage and started something new. And we see that over and over again. There's a fascinating story of the history of peat for Holland, linked from the digging deeper thing there. And I should pause and say something that I would have said earlier about how the Marcellus Shale has gotten people suddenly very, very interested in energy in a way that hasn't come about before. And we see this as a teachable moment for luring folks in to get them to think about the larger energy system and think about where their energy comes from. And that, I should have said, in as a precursor to coming to the graph on the changing electric system. The graph shows our changing generation, but it's also important to think about how our use is changing. And we're all part of that right now. 2% of U.S. electricity production goes to data centers. And that's got ripple effects throughout the energy system that allows me, for example, to walk downstairs to go to work rather than drive wherever it is that my office might be. But I am sitting in my study in my home now while I work in Ithaca, New York. I work in Buffalo, New York at the same time. And that has changed a lot of the energy system in fairly profound ways. So that's a little bit about change over time. And looking at the going back to the map of the U.S., we can see that energy use varies geographically tremendously as well. New York State is unusual in that its four largest power plants are all fueled by different sources. The largest is the Robert Moses Hydro Plant in Niagara Falls. The second largest is the Ravenswood Natural Gas Plant, which is actually dual-fired and can burn petroleum as well in Queens, I think. And then the third largest is the Nine Mile Point Nuclear Power Plant in Oswego, and the fourth largest is the Oswego Harbor Power Plant, which is a petroleum-fired power plant also in Oswego. Most states don't have that much diversity. If you look at large sections of the country, you can see that there are a lot of states that are very heavily dependent on coal. Hawaii, you can see, is heavily dependent on petroleum, which you know isn't indigenous to there. And it varies a lot across the country. And so there's change across time and across space for energy. And this goes to the point that we expect that we'll go back to more people having more energy come, a larger percentage of their energy coming from their backyard, metaphorically speaking. And they may not like the implications of that. Although if you put it on your roof, that may not be a big deal. But if it's natural gas coming out of the ground, you might not like that. So, zoom on, and I did make up my time, that's good. And looking at the scales now and the costs and benefits
of the Marcellus, and one of the costs, or one of the benefits, rather, is that natural gas has half the CO2 emissions of coal, which is also one of the costs. It's still a fossil fuel. It is still environmentally damaging to go through the process of taking that stuff out of the ground. A plus is that methane burns cleaner than coal or oil, but methane leaks, and it's a potent greenhouse gas, and we really don't have a great sense of how much it leaks. There is a real scientific battle going on Cornell's campus about that question between different scientists who have different answers to how much the leakage is from the fracking process. And at least as importantly is that we also don't really have a great sense of how much methane leaks from coal mining. So that makes it very hard to compare the different energy sources. Another plus is that there are jobs associated with it, and much of upstate New York is pretty economically depressed, but it's a boom-bust economic cycle, so those jobs may last only primarily during the building phase and the drilling phase and not last beyond that. So that brings us back to our key questions and key ideas and key question. And I'm going to go off to looking at a statistic and a question to follow up on that. And that statistic is that one large nuclear power plant, and pictured here is the 4.6 gigawatt Bruce Generating Station, which is between 100 and 150 miles from where I'm sitting right now, across the border in Ontario, and is right now the largest operating nuclear plant in the world, because the largest plant that there is in Japan and currently offline. That produces as much electricity as 3,000 large windmills or 50 square miles of photovoltaics. And this shows a picture of one of the largest photovoltaic arrays in the Northeast, also about 10 miles from where I'm sitting, at the University of Buffalo campus. And it's a quarter mile long. If I wanted to generate as much electricity from that as the Bruce Nuclear Generating Station produces, it would need to be extended from here to Denver, so from Buffalo to Denver. So one of the real sticky issues with helping people understand why we're so dependent on fossil fuels has to do with scale, and the scale that you can produce from renewables right now is pretty small, and the energy density is pretty low, comparatively speaking. The energy equivalent of a man's day's labor is 3 tablespoons of oil. So the energy that a man does in a day's work is the energy in 3 tablespoons of oil. So that's why we love it. But it's got serious costs with it. Now, looking at photovoltaics, of course, you wouldn't line them up in a single strand going from here to Denver. Hopefully, you'd put a lot of those up on roofs. But there's no doubt that no matter how you make lots and lots of energy, you damage the environment. So I think that quick fly-through gives a pretty decent overview of a lot of the relevant information. I did fly through the Marcellus stuff more quickly and can go back to that if we want to. But providing information isn't enough to build scientific understanding. The sociocultural issues, sociocultural issues matter a great deal. We know from lots of discussions on amongst this group that more information has a tendency to polarize people further. And very importantly, controversial issues involve conflicting worldviews. People get very upset about this stuff on both sides of the issue. And in my title of the talk, I've used the term gateway drugs. And I just want to rattle through a couple of different sort of gateway drugs that are all things
by the way, that the Paleontological Research Institution has some connection to. Evolution is seen as a gateway drug to atheism. Global warming or environmental regulation are seen as gateway drugs to socialism. And hydraulic fracturing and nuclear power is seen as gateways to environmental ruin. And that's why people get so very emotional about these issues, is that it has to do with worldviews, and it has to do with loss aversion to things that are very, very personal to people and very, very central to the way, their way of seeing the world. So that, I think, is almost my end. So the implications of extracting gas from shale are better understood from a systems perspective, and reducing energy demand is fundamental to reducing environmental degradation. So that's a very quick fly-through of part of what we're up to. I can talk more about the nature of our work with educators and what we're up to there, and I can talk more about the nature of the relevant science and social issues, and I know Joe Henderson's online too, who has been working on this issue about as long as we have. And I also know there's somebody from the DEC who might be able to answer some questions too. So let's go to discussion.
Great. Thanks, Don. Are there any questions?
I'm hearing that demand-side management is a really important consideration.
Figure out how to turn the volume up on me.
Oh, here it is.
Oh, okay.
So go ahead and ask your question.
Do we have a list of solutions and pros and cons of each? And I think you were trying to get that information at one time to try to put together such a table that people could look at the pros and cons of all the different options.
Yeah, we're gradually working on that, putting together an energy report card.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that will be an eventual product of the project. It's proven to be non-simple, or of course somebody would have done it, and the reality is that there are a number of energy report card kinds of things out there. And all of the ones that we've found so far are produced by someone with a pretty clear advocacy agenda.
Right.
So the nuclear power industry, for example, has an energy report card, and you can guess who gets the highest score from the nuclear power industries.
Yeah, well, it seems to me that even if you are capable of doing one that's totally agnostic in terms of any kind of advocacy, that any individual person or group would have different values, and so
that's right.
How they would then rank them, based on just would be different. So it becomes more complex to determine that there's not any one good solution.
That's right, and part of our approach to dealing with that, which again is in a very drafty form at this point, is to allow people to decide how they want to weight different considerations. So, how much does water pollution matter to you? How much does the cost per kilowatt hour matter to you? And as long as you come up with a percentage that adds up to 100%, you can then compare different energy sources using your weighting. But hopefully we'll be able to provide some good grounded science in the different areas that are of interest.
This is David Barnett.
It's a complex problem.
This is David Barnett, and I was just thinking along the same lines, except that can we do it in a way that provides some equivalency? In other words, for a certain amount of energy, you had the equivalency in terms of the photovoltaics versus the large power plant, doing that in relation to, a certain amount of energy in coal and oil and try to make it equal.
Yeah. Well, that would be part of the equation, I guess, for or the rubric is looking at one kilowatt hour of electricity, for example, or one BTU or 1,000 BTUs some common level or amount of energy being produced. And I think we want to pay good attention to not only the question of should we use this kind of energy, but should we use this much energy, and in going after those, there's an awful lot of low-hanging fruit for energy efficiency, and then there's some more difficult-to-reach fruit for restructuring our infrastructure so that you have people not living in 6,000-square-foot houses in the exurbs and commuting an hour each way into whatever city they happen to be near, but thinking about the structure of urban planning as part of it, which is not technology, not really about technology, but about making changes in technique of how you go about your day. And that, in my view, at least as important as thinking about where the energy comes from.
And somebody said something about being an agnostic in terms of the energy choices, and I wonder whether the comparison could look at sort of in a life cycle sense, the consequences of the sourcing of the energy as well as its use, you know, the extraction of coal, the production and transport of oil, you know, the
That's
same
right.
thing, you know, include all those factors somehow.
Yeah. And we've produced a series of pamphlets that we call the Marcellus Papers, which include an introduction, a general introduction, the geology, the induced seismicity, the water going into the ground, the water coming out of the ground. Those are two separate pamphlets. And the energy transitions is actually the one that I wrote. And we are very slowly working on a life cycle analysis one, and it's slow going because it's so complex to figure out all of that life cycle stuff. But it is also so important that most people in Western New York, where I live, heat their homes with natural gas, and I think about 5% of New York State's natural gas is drilled within state, and the other 95% comes from surrounding states. So trying to make the argument that we don't want environmental damage from natural gas drilling, I think has some moral questions that maybe go with that. That if we don't like it, then how come we're using it? And if we don't like it, then what are we going to use instead are really fundamental questions that go to that life cycle issue.
I would like to ask, I'd like us to remember a modeling experience to visualize the complexity of climate change that Karen Holweg described probably a few months ago in a museum that was in Washington. And I'm imagining people trying to wrap their minds around the complexity of this.
Mm-hmm.
So my mind is going toward modeling and asking people, oh, well, if you want energy, what are your options? And is there a way that we could create a table in front of everybody that has these ways that you could move the options up and down and then see the life cycle consequences of using those things in order to get at the deeper values and trade-offs that need to be made. And we would like those decisions to be made where it's more transparent rather than more hidden as it has been.
This is Karen,
I was just thinking of that exhibit. It's at the Koshlin Museum of the National Academies.
Yeah.
And it does some of what you're describing, but it's computerized. So you use slide bars to say, I want more of this and less of that. I want less land torn up. I want you know, less air pollution, those kinds of things. And it does that exactly as you've described. But instead of being a static table, it's slide bars on a very complex, I'm sure, computer program.
Right.
So the technology behind what you use, I think, is a critical element.
This is Jeannie Troy from the Koshland. I'm delighted to hear our decision table being discussed. I think we'd love to hear ideas about how to adapt that for other uses.
Could you send me the link?
Unfortunately, because of it's not complex software. It's just the way the software is set up.
Yep.
It's not web-based, so you can come visit us.
Okay.
But I'll send a link to kind of general information about the exhibit.
That sounds great.
But what I think is really useful about that piece is that it's like you're playing a game and it has two targets, and one is an emissions reductions target, and the other is whatever kind of relative priorities you set. I mean, it's simplistic, so there are only four areas. So it shows that decision-making framework of, you know, a quantitative goal as well as thinking about what values you're laying onto that.
And because of that, it prompts discussions among the people who are at the various stations, because they're discovering things and asking themselves questions. And when I was there, they tended to be out loud questions.
Yeah, when we have, you can kind of parallel play. So.
Right. Well, it would empower people's minds to get at those deeper questions that you have identified so beautifully, Dawn.
Yeah, I'm definitely interested in learning more about what Koshland has for us to see.
Well, when you talk about these various kinds of decisions and their impacts, are you talking about these impacts as being, and this just could be part of the exhibit, for an individual or for a community or for a state or for the United States? Because I think that the scale of that impact, I mean, people do, it seems to me, a lot of people tend to vote, you know, based on their pocketbook, and that might be their whole perspective, and that it impacts the person next door might not matter to them. And so how do you take these relative values of various people and make a responsible decision for a community or for a state? And I find that really hard to struggle with, because it seems to me that you'll never get buy-in from even the majority.
Yeah, well, it's a very good question. And I think one of the ways of approaching that is that an awful lot of ways to use less energy, and again, you know, thinking about using less energy as much as thinking about where the energy source is very, very important. But one of the ways to look at that is that throughout the history of the world and human fuel use, the society that has the dominant technology, that controls the dominant technology for energy, or the dominant technologies, or controls some of the dominant technologies, is a world power. And the ones that don't, aren't. And I think if we look towards the future, it's hard to imagine, if you're 100 years from now, fossil fuels being the dominant energy. So if people are worried about pocketbooks and U.S. Power, then they need to look beyond fossil fuels, if history is any guide.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one other thing that I wanted to mention, that on Saturday I was at the Damon College Environmental Summit and tabling there for the Museum of the Earth and talking a little bit with people who came to the table about our Marcellus work, and probably half of the people there half the people I talked to anyway were people that I already know from the environmental community in Buffalo. And I had back-to-back conversations with an environmentalist who is strongly pro-fracking for a number of reasons. And he is, I would call him an acquaintance rather than a friend for the way he talks about things. But he essentially portrayed in the discussion anyone who disagrees with him that fracking is the way to go as an idiot. And then next came along a friend who is strongly anti-fracking, who portrayed anyone who is pro-fracking as evil. And it was this really stark dichotomous moment, sort of, where they're both wrong in important ways, and probably more important than being wrong is that they're not going to convince anyone who doesn't already agree with them that their position is better than the position that disagrees with them. And I think that's a really worthwhile, it was a sort of stark moment for me as an educator in thinking about this stuff. It's the way the poles in this issue talk to one another, and I think in other issues too, is really lousy at helping people understand their position. But you
hey, Don.
Yep.
Don, this is Joe. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Hi, everybody. This is Joe Henderson. One thing that I would add to all of this, too, that I haven't really heard discussed, and maybe it's kind of outside the purview of climate science or Marcellus science, but it seems to me in interacting in similar ways with what Don has said or just said, that one of the big issues that's happening in New York around power, and not just hydrofracking, but also wind power, solar power, a lot of those issues tend to be kind of civic and governance related issues. And so a lot of the protests, even around wind farms, is happening kind of at the local level. And now, at least around hydrofracking, there's kind of a push around how people do essentially deliberation or deliberative democracy at the state level. And DEC has gotten involved. And I think a substantial part of understanding all of this is understanding the mechanisms of government and kind of one's role in that, or perceived role, and I mean that not just in participating in the formal ways, but a lot of people participate in government in lots of kind of civil disobedient actions as well. And I wonder where that is in all of this analysis. And there was some talk about the discussion that happened at that museum exhibit. I wonder if that's a way to talk about these larger issues as well. I think you would hope that those conversations would be as scientifically informed as possible, but, you know, we all know that that's not, I don't know, maybe I'm cynical, but I doubt that that's going to happen. So I just throw that out there. I don't know how that gets represented anywhere.
It brings in problem solving isn't just about the science, but it's about people's sense of efficacy and how social science works. And Karen, that's going to be your ball game at the conference, isn't it?
We keep trying.
Yeah, and I'll note, too, that if you want to continue the discussion, Joe and I have a poster at NAAAE next week on this.
Good. Great. We'll see you there.
All right.
Yep, I will, too.
Excellent.
Yeah. These are the kinds of questions that I think every community is dealing with right now, at least every community that's thinking about it.
Yeah, and I actually should say, too, I should have said earlier on, part of what we're doing in our Marcellus Educator Professional Development Grant is using the Marcellus as a case study to develop approaches for any kind of emergent energy issue in a community. So in part inspired by the fact that we were pretty much blindsided at the Museum of the Earth at how quickly this arose as a controversial issue and how quickly it polarized communities. So we're trying to develop resources to help any community deal with emergent energy issues, be it windmills or a power line or Marcellus gas drilling or other kinds of shale gas or other sources of shale gas, I should say. So that's the big goal.
Well, and Don, what you've described is exactly what's happened in Boulder County, Colorado, mm-hmm. in less than a year. It just exploded.
Yep.
And it's got all the characteristics that you've described for your part of the country.
What just exploded there in Colorado?
Fracking.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And it's because there was a fracking well site located within, I don't remember how many yards of a school, and the parents went nuts, and mm-hmm. it just exploded from there.
Yep.
So the whole county is immersed in this quote, controversy about fracking, and despite the fact that the county is very involved in bigger energy production mm-hmm. consumption discussions, that's not even in the mix of the fracking discussion. It's just amazing.
Yeah, and it's and I'll throw this in as a related aside, the geology of fracking in the West and the geology of fracking in Pennsylvania and New York is fundamentally different, and that makes some aspects of the comparison more complicated of this already complex issue.
Don, I love your presentation. I've been messing around with Prezi, and I think you've used it very effectively. This is Roberta in Kentucky. One of the things that I really like is that you raise that essential question of, you know, would using less energy might be maybe a good idea. It seems like that is just never even being considered working, you know, not enough anyway. You know, here in the state level where I work, we're all about, you know, energy efficiency and you know, using energy more efficiently, but there it's all about energy development and independence and getting more cheaper energy, and we're mm-hmm. not ever emphasizing using less. And from an air regulatory standpoint, I keep looking at every year with the air standards getting tighter and, you know, having to meet those pollution standards as they get tighter and the population goes up, there's going to come a point where our downward trend of, you know, air pollution is going to start going up again. It just has to unless people stop using as much energy.
Right.
So part
of
the issue could be addressing energy efficiency.
Yeah.
Part of it. Though it's very important to think about what we mean by that because, for example, the computer that's sitting on my lap right now is way more energy efficient than the computer I had 15 years ago that sat on my desk. But now when I go to a hotel, I need three plugs, one for the phone that's the computer in my pocket, one that's the computer that's sitting on my lap, and one for the iPad that I, you know, used on the plane because I'm too big to use a laptop on a plane. So these are all way more efficient than the devices that they replaced, but we've got more of them. And we've got you know, an awful lot of people have a much more efficient refrigerator in their kitchen, which means the old refrigerator's down in the basement full of beer. And they've got a much more efficient television in their living room, and another one in each kid's bedroom and in the parents' bedroom and another one in the study. So those are the question of efficiency is complex.
Right. And I guess we always talk about energy efficiency as the low-hanging fruit. And it's
right.
Point, everybody is going to eventually catch up. It's going to catch up with itself. You know, cars are all the cars that are running on the road will eventually be far more energy efficient than they are now, and same with all of those other things. At some point, we're going to be catching up with ourselves, and we really are going to have to address our energy consumption.
Right, amount. Right. Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, so I want to point out that we're almost 10 minutes past the hour, so we've had a very interesting, lively discussion. And, Don, thank you very much for your presentation. And I think we'll call a close to our Telecon today, and we'll talk again next week.
Thanks, all, and we'll see you in Oakland.
Thank you.
Bye.
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 Thank you. That was a great presentation.
Thanks.